From the New Hampshire Institute of Politics on the campus of St. Anselm College, welcome to New Hampshire Live. Hosted by the Institute's Executive Director, Neil Levesque, New Hampshire Live offers an inside look at all things political in the Granite State.
This week we feature Ohio Governor John Kasich speaking and taking questions from our podium here at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, where he talks about his new book, Two Paths, America Divided or United. Here is Governor John Kasich.
It's so great to be back here, and people are interested, why is he back? Well, I have an announcement. I'm back to sell books. Now, I wanted to come here because I have deep positive emotions about the time that I spent in this great state. I mean, I just love it, and there's so many people who took a chance on me. I don't want to get into all these names, but Bruce Berkey, by the way, he's been supporting me for like 100 years, and he and his wife Nancy are great. But you know, it was a big deal to get the Skamas early on, and of course, you can't make it anywhere without Ruthie Griffin. But Ruthie, Trump beat me. What did you? You're slipping. But we did very, very well here. And you know, normally, if you are, here's what is really astounding to me. I thought that I was known, and you know, you are the budget committee chairman, you're a congressman, so you think people know you, right? And then here I go. I go on to Fox, and I'm there for almost 10 years on the show. And then I become governor, and you know, I'm governor of the seventh largest state. And you know, and then I come here, and I find out that my name identification was under 2%. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? You would think you'd be known, and you weren't known. In fact, I wasn't known really anywhere in the country. Why would that be the case? Well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, I didn't screw up as governor, so that, therefore no one wrote me. I also didn't live in D.C. So if you were in D.C. and you just shut the government down every other week, people cover you because the reporters fall out of bed and can cover you. They don't have to get on a plane, a train, or anything else. So you get a lot of exposure when you're down there, particularly when you're doing things that, you know, disrupt, because that's what we're into. We're all into disruption. You know, I don't want to know things went well. I just want to know that, you know, how somebody's screwing up or they're colorful or whatever. Or you're in the New York media market. I'm not complaining about this, it's just a fact of life. So when you're in the great unwashed Midwest, they can do stories about you, but stories don't get it. There has to be a constant, steady drumbeat. So I don't know what I would have done had I realized that my name ID was under 2%. John Sununu played a big role because he said you need to come here and you'll do well and all that kind of stuff. So that was the first thing that was interesting to me. The second thing that was interesting is being governor of the state made it difficult to run for president. Who would think that you could be governor, you could be doing a good job, even if it's negative, is because when you get a job like that and you have a position like that, you can't go around making crazy promises. You have to be in a position of where you're responsible. Now maybe you could be a crazy governor and do all that other stuff, but that wasn't what, you know, what I felt I should do. And so, you know, instead of being able to get out there and say, you know, on day one, I'm gonna rip up the Iran deal, I'm gonna ship 13 million Muslims out of the country, we're gonna, you know, notice all that promise? It's all been taken back. And so, but in the course of running for president, something happened to me that never happened before. I was like so boring, you know? And boring didn't cut it. People were not interested in boring. They wanted, here's what I think they wanted to know. And many people were very upset, many of them still are. And it's understandable. You know, let's just use this as a sort of a metaphor. A lot of Americans were on that United Airlines flight and we all got dragged off. So somebody said, I'm not gonna take it anymore. You know, my job is not going well, I'm not making much money, my family is, my kids can't get a job, and by the way, it all happened because it was your fault and I'm gonna fix all of it. And that's what was resonating. And by the way, I can fix it overnight because I wanna have an app? Can you give me an app to fix it? I could just have an app. I could have everything I want. Or I can take a pill. And I can just take a pill and everything's going to be magic. Life doesn't work that way. And over time, I think people are going to settle down and realize that the difficulties that we face cannot be solved without unity. The difficulties cannot be solved unless we have deliberate and steady solutions to the problems. And I want to tell you something that I think you're going to see is going to happen. And I know it's going to happen, but I hope it doesn't happen the way that I see it. The number one occupation in America is driving. Think all those people that you see, the FedEx driver, well, all these drivers. You know, within 10 years, people aren't going to be driving because we're going to have autonomous vehicles. And not only that, but we're also going to be having drones that are going to be delivering things to our house. And it's going to disrupt. I mean, if driving is the number one occupation and all of a sudden we're not going to need anybody to drive, then where are these people going to work? Artificial intelligence. You know, you see these, I don't know if any of you ever see this thing called Watson on TV, IBM Watson. Watson tells people, oh, well, here's what you need to do. That's artificial intelligence. So people like stockbrokers and insurance adjusters are likely to find themselves out of work. So the question is, what do we do about it? And do we have an education system that's training people? And if all of a sudden, because of the digital revolution, we find people really displaced and their lives really disrupted. If you think we have division now, think about what that's going to be like. And that's why it is so important for our education systems to change. Now, but I can go on and on and on here. I gotta watch myself here, Mr. Shays. But here's what I will tell you. The most important part of this book, in my opinion, is that we all need to live a life a little bigger than ourselves. That we have to care about our neighbors. We can't be self-absorbed where the only thing that matters is me on my smartphone and this is all I care about. And to go back to the United Airlines counter, first of all, the rules at the top must have been pretty stupid, but here's the other question. Ruthie, if you were working at that counter and they told you you're going to go on that plane and drag that guy off of there, I don't think you would have cooperated. Because you would have said, that's not right. We don't treat people like that. That's not the way I was raised. So the idea that we would live a life a little bigger than ourselves and we would assume responsibility. Now, yesterday I was at Harvard. The other day I was on The Daily Show. Here is the funny thing about The Daily Show. They did a segment on Alabama. And they went to this church and it was sort of a tongue-in-cheek laughing at some of these people down there about religion. And so I'm in a green room and I'm getting ready to go out. And one of my guys who's traveling with me, he says, because he knows what I'm seeing when I'm seeing this thing, he says, just go out there and sell books, John. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And so I went out there and I started to talk about the importance, after a little while, of religion. And I think religious people, some, have given that a name. First of all, they get themselves involved in endorsing candidates, which I think is an outrage. And secondly, their message of condemnation and who's sleeping with who doesn't get it from me. What religion is to me is a connection, a connectivity to your neighbor. It's a perspective about how to handle difficult things in life. And it's about the fact that life is short and you do the best you can here to make the place better, a little bit better. So when I think about our education institutions and this potential tsunami that's coming at us because of the digital revolution, what is it going to take to get the people who run those institutions to wake up and change the way in which they do things? Because right now, it's, well, it's with all of us. None of us like to change anything. We want to drive to work the same way. We want to study the same way. We want to go to places the same. It's what we want to do. And change is hard for people. But if you change, you find that there is a new life, there is innovation, there is a certain freshness to everything, and you're going to be remembered for the things that you did, not for what your job was or how much money you made. And so it's on all of us to try to carve out our future. And that means that we ought to all spend about 10 minutes a day reading something that we don't agree with. Because what's been happening is we are, all of us are absorbing only that that we agree with and getting rid of those things that we don't agree with. And my mother and father told me, as I think your whoever raised you told you, you got to be able to listen in life. You need to have an open mind. But if our minds are closing, you tell me how we're supposed to solve problems, because nothing gets solved. I don't care if it's a broken down tractor on a farmer's field. Nothing gets solved if the people don't come together to fix it. Am I right, God? That's where the neighbors show up and they say, okay, what are you doing here? And you work together. And that's a large part of what is ailing us in this country. And I wrote this book because I love my country. And I love my 17-year-old twins, and I want them to have a great America. And so if we all just think about what we can do to contribute to the common good, we don't need to be saints. I mean, nobody's looking for sainthood. I'm the farthest thing from it. But if we can just think about what we can do to serve and leave a positive legacy in wherever we are, then I think that this country will be stronger, and I think we will be healed, and it all starts with us. The final thing that I say, and then we're going to go to some questions here, I hope, is I went down to Atlanta at the invitation for Bernice King, who is the daughter of Martin Luther King. And I was being interviewed on stage, and there were about 500-600 people sitting out there. And they were, I'd say it was about 98 or 99% African American. And so during the questions and everything, we went to the audience, and one guy yelled, "What about Trump? What about Trump?" I said, "Really? What about Trump?" I said, "What about your neighbor? What about your kid? What about your community? Why are we spending so much time thinking about something that really, in most cases, doesn't even affect us like our normal life affects us?" And when I thought about King, you know, and I said, you think about Dr. King. Dr. King could not get a meeting with the top politician. You know, they were all afraid. They didn't want to meet with him. Oh, it's too hot an issue, the issue of race. So what happened? He organized the communities. He drove things from the bottom up. He didn't go, he couldn't get a meeting. And then when the people decided they had enough, all of us, Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, rich and poor, the message from the community got driven to the top and change happened. So if you're wondering about how we're going to get ourselves back, communicating, talking, and by the way, these politicians in Washington, if you think they're going to get together and fix things, check under your pillow tonight. The tooth fairy is coming. The system is dysfunctional. And this is again back to the fact that they're a heck of a lot more interested in their own re-elections and their own self-interest than they are the public. But we're all kind of caught that way. And we tend to focus just on the politicians. We got to think about what we're doing in life. And are we willing to make certain sacrifices and again, serve the common good? You'll find some things in this book about what it was like in New Hampshire for me in the early stages of a campaign. But I like to think that the message is a lot broader than that. It's alarm and saying that we can do this if we do it together. So that's enough. I didn't go through all the shades. Okay, and my friend is here. He and I were just like brothers, you know. So he drove up. He's at Harvard. He couldn't get a job teaching at Ohio State, so he settled for Harvard. How about some questions? No questions? I can. Oh, we got a young guy. Okay, who are you?
I'm Randy Martin from Dare, New Hampshire, and I'm the manager at the Robert Frost Farm. I welcome you all to come. It's open. And if you're from New Hampshire, you get a deal. Anyway, I just have one question, and that is, how did you manage to be governor of Ohio, run for president, and write a book? Have you been writing this book for a long time, or did you just do it after the race?
Well, you know, We're having some issues now with our revenues, which almost every state in the country is. And so that is a concern, and I'm on that all the time. And my chief of staff came up yesterday. But by and large, being governor has not been a really hard thing for me. And the reason why it isn't is because I don't kind of do this. You know, we had the issue of expanding Medicaid. That just freaks out all these Republicans. And so it freaks me out when I think about the fact that the federal government offered a partnership where I could now provide health coverage to 700,000 people, a third of whom are drug addicted and mentally ill, and a quarter of whom have chronic illness. So when they came in, they presented this to me, and my Medicaid program was in really good shape, and it was under control, and we were innovating. So of course, we're going to expand. When you are in politics and you're trying to figure out how to make everybody happy, that's when things get complicated. Now, when you make decisions and you go forward, you're going to take some hits. Okay, so what? I mean, you know, that's not that big of a deal. And so being governor, running for president, you know, we have these things, cell phones, they work. You can actually, well, in most places you can go, let me rethink that. So it was really relatively easy to stay in touch because I got to run the state. And now with writing a book, the way that I do a book is I have a guy that has worked with me on, this is the third book, he and I work together. And he comes to my home. And then we spend 2 or 3 days probably recording, I don't know, 15 to 20 hours worth of things that I think. And then he badgers me and prods me to get more out of me. So we have all this stuff recorded. And like sometimes I'll go to sleep and it'll be, you know, 11 o'clock. And I'll wake up in the morning and what I had said at 10 o'clock, I sort of amplified or changed or amended or whatever. And then it gets transcribed. And then once it's transcribed, it's put on paper, and then it's sent to me, and then I go through it and keep redoing it the way that I want to. And then I had to do a recording of the book, which took me 15 hours to record this book. And in the process of recording it, you really are reading it so carefully that you then make additional changes to the book. It's a great process. I mean, and now you get a chance to go out and talk about it and sell it. And so, you know, I'm still running the state and all that kind of stuff. When I left politics, when I left Congress, I worked, you know, for Lehman Brothers. I was at Fox News. I made speeches. I taught, and I was on boards of companies. And I had more that I could do. I've been able to multitask in my life, and I've never found it that difficult. So the last book, which was my faith book, I wasn't able to promote as much because I don't know why I didn't. There was a reason why I couldn't do it. But it did pretty well. And this one, that one was important to me. This one, I think, in some ways, is the most important thing because this is a compilation of 28 and a half years of being in public life and in the country and making observations that I want people to buy it, not because, you know, I need you to buy it. I want you to read it. You know, if you don't buy it, I don't care. But read the book because I think it will be give you some insights that will help us. So.
Hi, Governor. Thanks for being here. Just on. All right. You mentioned that expecting Congress to not be dysfunctional is like leaving the tooth fairy. That's probably especially the case when it comes to our disappointing budget process. What do you think needs to happen to help Congress get beyond that dysfunction? That certainly needs to happen to help us get back to regular order. And how would you encourage citizens to get involved in that process?
Well, I think it's been great that people have been out there yelling. The only thing I don't like about it is if it leads to some sort of hatred. I mean, there's everything's good about activism. You know, I want the environment, or I'm marching for women's rights. And that's good. But you don't want that to spill into some sort of blind philosophy here where you can't even talk to anybody else. I mean, it's important that you're able to communicate beyond that one issue. But here's what's happened. People have given up bowling and they've taken up politics. So they sit in front of their television all day, and if they're a liberal, they consume the liberal stuff, and if they're a conservative, they consume the conservative stuff, and then they follow that up with everything else they consume. And then they become political experts. And then what happens is they become very, very strong in terms of what they demand of the people who represent them. And in the course of all this, we created redistricting, this thing called gerrymandering. So we cut these districts up so that this is safe Republican or this is safe Democrat. A Democrat can't win in a Republican district, and a Republican can't win in a Democrat district. And then what happens is with the people who are so knowledgeable now about politics, get my tongue out of my cheek, they then demand that this representative act a certain way. And if you don't act the way they want, if you're a Republican, they primary you from the right. Well, if you're a Democrat, they primary you from the left. And all it does is move everybody like that. So what can happen? First of all, we ought to get this gerrymandering. We have to change things so that both parties have to agree to whatever the maps would look like. That would force a change in the way these lines are drawn. Secondly, people should spend 10 minutes a day trying to read something other than what they disagree with, because we can't have the people in the constituencies just demand, saying that if you compromise, you're a traitor. I don't know anything that's happened. If I went around here and looked at these pictures of, Neil, I mean, I see Bradley and I see Bernie. Neither of them are present. Where's my picture? And there's Hillary. What am I, Trump liberal? Why am I here? Pathetic. If you look around at the people who were elected, you know, compromise is part of how you get things done and make it lasting. And then I think the people who are in public life have to realize, as Chris Shays and Dick Sweat did, you know, being in public office is not the end all be all. There's great life after you're elected. I was with a state representative the other day who was a senator. He was shaking in his boots about, well, when I'm out, I mean, what's going to happen to me? You know, we should have a resident like psychiatrist. But and they want to hold on. And so the ability to reach out and take a risk. And look, you know, my wife says, I listen to my wife a lot. She said, you know, John, it's really easy for you to talk about people standing up. But when people have mortgages and children and college debt and everything else, it ain't so easy. Of course, she's right, which is why I don't like to get her advice all that often. But I mean, it's hard. But you know, at the end of our lives, we are remembered for what we did. I mean, you take Ruthie Griffin. People in this state love her. Why? Because she's just a remarkable woman who's always looking for the higher purpose. Okay, she just is, right? Or any of that stuff. I mean, that doesn't matter to her. So, sir, I also think we have to push the message out that we're not willing to put up with it. And I'll tell you something, you need to know something about politicians. They live in fear of their constituents badgering them. Am I right, guys? In fear. You don't agree? Maybe you did, but how do you think most of them are? That's so hard for me to do. I can't vote on that. You know, it's crazy. That's why we have a crisis of leadership and of followership. Okay, yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Zach Taylor.
One second. Did that answer your question? I think we. And I'll tell you another thing. Money in politics is ruining it too. Here's what I predict is going to happen. The political parties don't matter as much. And I actually believe it is going to be possible for a well-funded or rich independent to get elected president of the United States and have the parties just go the other way. I just think that, I don't know many young people who say, oh, I want to go to the young Republican meeting or I'm going to the young Democrat meeting. They're not that interested. They're interested in independent thinking, and that's, I think, the rise of the independent is going
to
happen.
Yeah, so my question kind of ties to that. So being a young voter, I definitely want to see a president elected who's more focused on compromising and getting good collaborative legislation passed instead of perfect legislation for the left or the right. And I think that the primary system has really made it difficult for candidates like yourself who are moderate and really take common sense when they're thinking of policies to get through. And so I'm wondering on your thoughts of a potential independent primary system like they have in Louisiana and California, and how if you have Democrats and Republicans on the same stage. The more people and the more moderates in the middle to get more attention.
Well, part of that is the media. Now, you know, here's in their responsibility. So I called this executive of one of the major networks, and I said, you know, man, you made $1 billion covering Trump, and now they're going to want you to make another billion. And that's fine, but when you're making the second billion, are you going to be able to look yourself in the mirror? Because there was a time in the campaign where the media would, there's here, empty podium. They put the empty podium on because they were getting ratings in anticipation of Trump coming out and saying something that was outrageous. And so the question is, how's the media conduct themselves? Now, they're in a real box because it's all clicks for cash. So, you know, I work for a paper. If I don't write a big headline, then nobody's going to read it. If they don't read it, then the paper's going to go down. And so I got to just go and do whatever I can do. The issue gets to be about, again, we're back to responsibility. Are you willing to just sell out your basic principles in order to make money, or are you willing to figure out a way to be interesting and get viewers, you know, with a more traditional way of approaching things? The other thing is, yeah, I think the idea that you have these jungle primaries, or I don't care. I mean, it doesn't matter to me. Any system that comes out that says that we can have candidates that propose solutions rather than just get headlines by saying crazy things makes sense to me. And you know, these are all things that are difficult to unravel. We were in Congress. Dick and Chris are buddies. We could get along. It's all deteriorated over the last 20 years. So if it deteriorated over the last 20 years, it's not going to be fixed overnight. It's going to take time for leaders to say, this is wrong, let's knock it off, let's serve the country. And if in the course of it I lose my election, so what? Because you know what? They'll never lose their election. You don't lose your election because you take strong positions. It just doesn't happen. You lose your elections when you become namby-pamby and weak. That's because people sense, you're not really a leader. I don't want you representing me. So there's no law we can write. There's some changes we can make in the system, but it's you know, it's just going to take time. Yes, sir.
Hi, Governor Kasich. Thank you for coming. My question as a college student revolves around the issue of free speech on college campuses. Fortunately, at this awesome school, we don't really have to deal with free speech problems very much, but other larger schools. Other large schools seem to have this problem, and so my question is, as college students, what do you think can be done to address this issue, and how do you think it can be solved?
Well, let me be clear. When I'm done being governor, I'm going to be opposed to free speech. it gets to be about the leadership of the school. This is becoming, you know, since I was a young man, everybody's like, oh, my kids go to college, they're all liberals, and they're just filling their heads with all this stuff. My God, I've been hearing this forever. You know, kind of the way I look at it is, you get raised, and then you go to school, and you hear a completely different point of view, and, you know, you leave, and you kind of go back to normal. I don't really sit around and worry. I mean, nobody likes to hear that, because that's too easy. But it's up to the leaders of a university to be able to say, we're going to hear different points of view. And, you know, if I were president of a university and all of a sudden I wanted to have somebody and there was a threat of violence, I'd find out how real it was. We don't want to have to find out who's trying to incite the violence and all those kinds of things. But I would want to have as much free thought as I could possibly have without endangering the public. And I think in most cases you can have a wide variety of speakers. And but I'm not sure that I would want to be inviting somebody who was going to give hate speech. I don't think I would favor that. But I've never been in that position to think about it. But it seems to me the more open the better, but you know, there's limits to anything. Okay? Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Zach, and I'm a proud public school teacher. I graduated from St. Anselm, and one of the things that I've learned new leadership is the appointments of people who have little to no experience in the public education world and are starting to make proposals that threaten public
school. You mean in Washington?
Yes. Yeah. That threaten public school teachers in public education. I just was wondering where you stand on public education at the federal and the state.
Yeah, I'm for it. You know, I was up here in a forum, and I said something that really got everybody worked up. I said, if they said, what education reform would you have? I said, well, if I were king, I would abolish teachers' lounges. And everybody got, like, in fact, one of my friends, who I was playing golf with a couple weeks ago, he says, well, I heard you say that, and my daughter's a teacher, and what? And I said, whoa. Here's what happens. Teachers go into the lounge, and then people feed them information about how everybody hates them and how their jobs are going to be taken away and their benefits cut and all hell's going to break loose. And it isn't even true. But if you sit somebody down and say, oh my, it's coming. Ruthie, it's coming. It's the bad is coming and they're after us. And they hear it day after day. So there's many public school teachers that think that they are disrespected and not liked. And that's baloney. That is not true. But you go in those lounges and you hear so much of that. Now, Washington. What do you care about? What are you worried about? You think what Betsy DeVos does in Washington is going to affect you in the school district? I wouldn't even know how that would happen.
I hope not.
Well, I don't know how it would even happen. It's like Common Core. By the way, have we forgotten that? And that's a bad one coming at us. That's going to destroy everything. I don't even hear about Common Core anymore. That was another one of those kind of those things, shots over the moon, you know, oh, we're all worked up about this. And, I heard on the radio, by the way, they're taking over. You know, it's unbelievable stuff. So we begin to get nervous. So how much is Washington going to affect you? Not much, okay? What I'm concerned about is what's happening in your school. Now, I made a proposal to my legislature. It wasn't my brainchild. It was a group of people who serve on a workforce board, and they're business people. And they made two recommendations. Think about this. One, in light of what I said about the digital revolution in this country, we should put three non-voting business people on every school board. Why? To talk about the kind of curriculum that you ought to have so that we're giving the young people skills for the future so that they can be resilient and have skills and value so they can get a job. Right at this point so far in my legislature, it's rejected. Why is it rejected? I think the school establishment doesn't like it. Okay, let me give you the other one. That when a teacher goes to get recertified, they ought to spend a few days out in a business understanding workforce. Rejected. Are you kidding me? What are we doing? I mean, you know what it is? Nobody's taking this seriously. And by the way, if I'm part of the education establishment, don't try to change me, because I know what I'm doing. This is a very, very serious problem in this country. Now, there are schools that are changing. We have a school called Cristo Rey. It's a Catholic operation. And you hire these young people, and they come to work for you. And it's happening all over Ohio. We just had a Cristo Rey school. It's all poor. It's a lot of minorities. These kids go out, and they're working in state government now. And they're not just going there and passing time. They're actually learning things. That school, which only was operating for a few years, just had the graduation ceremony, and 100% of the kids in that school are going to college. 100%. Now, what do? They spend some time in the classroom, and they spend a lot of time out in the real world. Now, my principal of my girls' school says to me, he says, John, never let education get in the way of learning. And so I believe that the public schools, first of all, they ought to be using very significant online education, where they can be taught by some of the greatest people in the world. Are they doing it? Probably not. How much of the time are the schools getting our young students out into the workplace? Senator, did they ever have them come to your office and work? Why not? Did they ever have the people who are interested in agriculture come and work on your farm for a few hours each week? I don't think so. So how are they supposed to learn this stuff? So, sir, the last thing I'm worried about is Betsy DeVos. What I'm worried about is your school and what you're doing with those students in your school. And it is hard for these big organizations to change. And the other thing is if you're sitting in the teacher's lounge being told that everybody hates you, then when I say, well, you need to change, they're like, well, they're not changing. Now, in a county in the state of Ohio, Marietta, which was one of the first settlements, they start in kindergarten teaching kids about occupations. In a kindergarten, it's cool. And then as it gets older, they get kids out into the community. The business community pitches in, the education system. You know, the problem there is there's one woman that's driven all this and she's worried about her funding. That lady's got it right. That school district, and they got three or four school districts working together. Do they work together in New Hampshire? Do they share their expenses? I don't know whether they do or not, but this is what I worry about. Then you go to college, right? Let me tell you about the colleges for a second. The costs are, I don't know what's going on here, but the costs are so high. Let me ask you this. Well, you know, you could go to Georgia Tech. AT&T worked with Georgia Tech, and they came up with a computer science master's degree. You know what it costs? $6,000. And you take this in your own home at your own speed. Ruthie, if you went the normal route, what would a master's degree at a university cost in computer science? It would be what, $30,000 or something? I don't know. Higher, Chris? Higher? Okay, this is $6,000. Now, and let me give you a couple other things. Our universities should be focused on their core mission. They shouldn't be owning golf courses and they shouldn't be owning dorms. And, I mean, it's just so old. And these costs, it's gonna do themselves in. Our education systems will be disintermediated if we're not careful. And the public education is great. Now, so you know, I think there's a combination of online, offline, getting kids out, focusing on the skills. So I have businesses now beginning to say, these are the jobs that are likely to disappear, and these are the jobs that we're likely to have. How do we prepare people for that? That's what we need to think about. You ought to go back to Harvard and Yale to be thinking about these kinds of things, Chris. No, I mean, seriously, these are really, really important things. So, no. Thank you. Good luck. Thanks for teaching. What do you teach?
Seventh grade English.
Good for you. Give them a round of applause.
Hi, Governor. I'm a freshman here at St. Anson College in the ambassador program. And I had a question. As someone who worked in Congress for a very long time, having worked across the aisle with other people in order to get things done, you've noticed in the last couple decades that the rise of executive power, the rise of executive decisions has kind of bypassed Congress in a way, whether it was maybe the last administration with immigration, there's people got upset about that, but it's this administration with, executive orders and overseas and foreign policy, like the strike on Syria and people. So I want to get your take on executive power kind of bypassing Congress in more recent years as someone who worked.
Are you 18 years old?
I just turned 19.
Just turned 19. Well, that's a good paper for you to write for your professor and check it out. No, I think it's good. As an executive, I like the growth of an expanded executive power. Look, I mean, we hear about all these executive orders. Most of them aren't worth the paper they're printed on. They're just show, okay? Now, the fact that a president can take a military action, that's necessary. You don't want to go to Congress and ask them for that kind of stuff. So there's a proper balance between an executive being able to do certain things and an executive overstepping their bounds. I mean, that's what the battle is in all the courts. Now, you had President Obama doing some things, by the way, that people didn't like. They thought he overshot, and probably did. And now you have President Trump going about it, and you have activist judges who are saying, no, that's not. And I think sorting that out is important, because you don't want to have the pendulum swing too much towards the executive, but also not too much to Congress. So I'll give you a good example. We have a military infrastructure. Oh, that was fun when I was up here, by the way. It was in the base, and oh my God. Kelly was freaked out, and I mean, it was unbelievable. I was talking about our infrastructure. You know how much infrastructure we have? If you have a base, I don't care whether you need it or not, you're gonna fight to keep it. You know how long it took to get the Congress to approve a system of getting rid of unnecessary assets in the military? That means a big increase in military spending. I got one question for you. Why don't they reform the military when they're doing it? But that's too hard. Because, you know, like the base here, you would come up here and say, well, I don't know, is this base supposed to be open? They'll come and kill you over that. You remember that little, you probably don't remember it, but my friends do. Remember that, Doug? I mean, everybody was so worked up, which Kasich's gonna close our base, you know? Well, the fact is we have too much of infrastructure. You turn that stuff over to Congress, they'll take 100 years to be able to deal with that. An executive should have the ability to make some decisions that you really don't want to go through a process where it takes too long for people to agree. But it's a balance, and I think that's why it's good that we have a court system that can check an executive who's getting too carried away. The other thing that we have to respect is, as much as I criticized and said some things about the press, thank God we have a free press, because the free press is a hallmark of a free society. It really matters. You do a paper, you go to your professor, say, I want to do a paper for extra credit, and here's what I want to look at. I want to look at what executive orders really mean, which ones matter and which ones are just show. That would be worth it. If I were your teacher, I'd give you an A for that. Yes. I wanted to, it takes me to one issue I want to talk to you about, and that's the issue of drugs. Now, I've been working on it for 7 years. We're a major artery. Because of Ohio and its location, we're one day from Mexico, we're a couple hours from Chicago. People want to use the artery of Ohio. We think we're shifting some of them out of Ohio, but so then they go somewhere else. It's a big drug demand. And I'm very well aware of the problems that are up here and in many of the states across the country. So we've shut down pill mills, we've bust people. We now say a doctor can't prescribe more than 7 days to an adult and 5 days to a child, to kids, and all those kinds of things. And we've seen a significant reduction in the number of prescriptions. But I met with the DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, in Ohio about 2 weeks ago. And these guys, they're like 25 years, 28 years, 32 years. And I said, guys, what is the solution to this drug problem? And I was expecting maybe they would say, well, you know, I was holding my breath that they wouldn't say, you know, we'll legalize drugs or whatever. You know what they said? You can't arrest enough people. This whole business of drugs has to be solved through education in our schools. Starting in kindergarten and working its way up more aggressively all the way through graduation. We have a program in Ohio called Start Talking, where we are trying to tell kids, because kids here don't do drugs, there's a 50% chance they won't do it. I think that now interest is growing in our schools to be more aggressive on this. So I asked my school officials, or I invited 3,000 school entities on a conference call with the Attorney General and myself to talk about the drug situation. 300 people got on the call. If I'd have said I had an extra $1 billion to pass out, I would have had 7,000 people on the call. Everybody has to engage in this. The faith community has to be engaged. Think about how many people would hear a great message on a Saturday or Sunday, or even at the mosque. I don't care where it is. Our clubs, our Lions clubs and Rotaries and all that ought to take this issue on. Our schools have got to be aggressive in talking to kids on a regular basis about this. And we ought to be walking up to kids we don't even know and telling them to stay off the drugs. And if we do that, we'll begin to win this war. So now we focus on treatment, which is important. We focus on interdiction, which is critically important. But we have to kill the demand. And that's why it takes a whole community to work at killing this drug habit. And I believe that's the way you ultimately will have a win. Now, you have to tighten up the prescribing, and all these other things matter. But at the end, we have to kill the demand. Tell you what I worry about.
My girls are 17, so they're going to go to college, and they're going to go to a party, fraternity, sorority party, or whatever, and they're going to be with their pals, and somebody's going to say, oh, if we go in the back room, there's some pills over there. Try it just once. And then the question is going to be, what do my kids say? What do they say? That's the moment of truth. And I try to tell them, you start doing these drugs, you will destroy yourself. And you will destroy the purpose for which you were created. But folks, up here, every one of these schools, are these schools working at this? I don't know what's happening in New Hampshire. They ought to be working at it. We ought to be marching on it, you know, one day a month to get attention, and we got to keep our precious young people, and not just them, but the people who lose their jobs, the people who are poor, the people who have been ignored. We got to get to everybody, because drugs are not the answer. Thank you. I'll take a couple more minutes. For yes, one more. Okay.
I got
in the last one. You're yelling at me.
So you talked a little bit about the digitization and mechanization of processes and jobs. The way that could affect my country's future. I was just hoping to hear you talk a little bit about the relationship between clean energy technology and America's economic future.
Yeah, I believe, look, I'm concerned about the environment. I'm concerned about the destruction of the rainforest. We are trying to develop these renewables. Now, nothing gets done overnight. In my state, we have these mandates, these renewable fuel mandates, solar, wind, you know, whatever, and also important efficiency. These are mandates. My legislature changed the mandates into goals and sent me this legislation, and I vetoed it because I want us to develop alternative energy. Now, these other fuel sources are not going to go away. We can't, you know, you're up here in the middle of the winter, and you don't want to burn any coal. Okay, well, good luck. We don't have enough room for you. Well, come to Ohio. You can live with us. We'll keep you warm. But the fact of the matter is we need to develop these sources. And when we get a breakthrough on battery technology, it's going to be amazing for all of us. And by the way, the digital revolution that's coming is going to make life great. I mean, think about the, you know, Amazon Prime, or, you know, when they deliver your groceries within 24 hours. I mean, all this is designed to improve the quality of our life, but with it comes disruption. But in regard to what you're saying, we need to have a commitment to jobs that will come clean energy. And so I'm a big believer in it. My legislature's not going back, trying to give me another bill, even try to override a veto that I could. Good luck. Have fun. You're going to get another veto if you try to do it, because I'm not going to let Ohio go back into the wilderness. We're just finally starting to come out into the bright light, and I want them there. For example, Amazon, which is really important, they have 6,000 people working in Ohio in the cloud computing. They only have three operations in America, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, and one in my state, and this is very important to them. And we are, you know, where did we ever get off thinking of words? Conservative, conservation. Where did we go because we are conservative somehow? We where did this debate come about that we don't believe in anything around climate change? I don't understand. What is that about? It's ridiculous. So anyway, I'm concerned about our environment. I don't worship it, but I'm going to take care of it because that's what I think is expected of me. So good. I like your hoodie too. Another thing I want to tell you, something is new with me, and I saw Bruce Berkey and his wife, they look great. Bruce lost 20 pounds. So when the Olympics were over, I decided I wanted to look like those guys. So I took up swimming, okay? And I'm now swimming a half a mile. It takes me a week to get there. I love you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to New Hampshire Live, a production of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. For information on our events, please visit www.anselm.edu/NHIOP.